Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Triangulation, episode 295, recorded Monday, April 24th, 2017. Cory Doctorow. Triangulation is brought to you by Box.com, bringing people and ideas together so businesses can work as one. 71,000 companies, including the majority of the Fortune 500, are already on Box. For a free 2-week trial and to find out more, visit Box.com. And by Harry's, for guys who want a great shave experience for a fraction of what you're paying now. Harry's is so confident in the quality of their blades, they want you to try their shave set for free. Just pay shipping. Start your free trial today at harrys.com/triangulation. And by Square. Accept every card for the same rate and deposit your money fast with free chargeback protection. No commitment or hidden fees. Sign up now and get free processing on your first $500 in sales at square.com/triangulation. Some terms apply. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we get together with some of the smartest, most interesting people in technology. And you and I get to spend some time with them. You through our chat room at irc.twit.tv. And I through the miracles of... we don't know what, Skype, I guess. We're talking right now to Cory Doctorow. Thrilled to get him back on our network. He has his first adult novel in some time, Walk Away. It comes out tomorrow. Yay.
That's right. Yeah.
I just got a copy. Let's do the reveal. So this is the cover, which is a beautiful cover, and then the slip cover, and then watch, because if you slide it off, there's a little something underneath. That's a cutout of an upside-down house. And then here's the beautiful dystopian future that we'll all be living in. Hey, Cory, good to see you. Welcome.
Good to see you, too. It's so great to be back on, Leo. I've missed you.
I missed you, too. Can I ask you how old Posey is?
She is 9.
Okay, that's how long it's been. Because the last time we talked, I think she was just born.
Yeah. So she's 9, and like she's actually read one of my books. She read real life, in real life, the graphic novel I did with Jen Wang. So she's now at the point where she's reading my books. It's pretty interesting.
I had a similar experience because a couple of Christmases ago, my daughter gave me one of your books. And it was the one on was it ethics? I can't remember.
Information doesn't want to be free.
I think it was that. It's an older book you did. There it is. She gave it to me, and I said, "You have no idea who that is, do you?" And she said, "No, but it's a great book." I said, "It is. It's a very great book." Aww. How many books have you written now, Cory?
You know, I was just trying to count the other day, and I don't know. It's like 23, I think. But there's one that's forthcoming, so that kind of spoils the count. But I've got a book coming out, probably 2018 now, that's a picture book for kids.
Stick to one genre. Do short stories, nonfiction. You've done one novel before this? One adult novel before this?
Oh, no.
How many have you done?
Let's count. Down and Out of the Magic Kingdom, Eastern Standard Cross.
See, I think of Down and Out as being more of a young adult.
No, it's definitely a novel for adults. I mean, that's how it's marketed anyway. Someone Comes to Town, Someone Leaves Town, Makers, and then the book I did with Charlie Strauss, Rapture of the Nerds. So that's 5.
Quite a few.
And then Walk Away is 6.
This is the newest, Walk Away. And because it's literally just came out, I mean, I think it comes out tomorrow.
Tomorrow, yeah.
We just got it yesterday, and so I haven't read very far. So first of all, I tell everybody, don't worry about spoilers. I don't know nothing.
Right.
But I love the start. In fact, the first sentence reminds me a little bit of your daughter, because the character in the beginning is Hubert Vernon Rudolph Clayton Irving Wilson Alva Anton Jeff Harley Timothy Curtis Cleveland Cecil Ollie Edmund Eli Wiley Marvin Ellis Espinoza. Henceforth referred to as Hubert, etc. Apparently, his parents used the top 20 names from the 1890 census to name him. Your daughter's name, do you mind me saying it? It's on Wikipedia.
No,
I guess it's not a secret. Your daughter's name, not quite so elaborate. Posey Emmeline Fibonacci Nautilus Taylor Doctorow.
Yeah.
So was that, maybe that was a little bit of the inspiration for Hubert?
A little bit, yeah. I always figure middle names are things you get for free, right? So I love the idea of hiding a lot of interesting stuff in the middle names. It's like header stuffing for people. When we were naming her, we had a lot of different ideas about what we could name her, and we ended up just going with like our top five. And so, yeah, the joke about Hubert is that his parents were members of the Anonymous Party, and then they became disaffected with it and left it when it adopted a real names policy. And so they gave him all these names as an act of political protest at the Anonymous Party's calumny and cowardice and lack of adherence to its principles. And that's meant to be funny, ha-ha, but it's also meant to be like ha-ha only serious, because there is this element in the book. A lot of it is about what happens when people who have very strong political beliefs start to compromise on them, and how compromise can slide you from, you know, don't be evil to surveillance capitalism in a bunch of very small steps that you don't even notice you're taking until one day you turn around and, you know, you're letting the NSA put a Prism server in your data center.
A lot of the names in this book are fantastic.
Aww.
And fantastical, like Limpopo and Gizmo von Puddleducks, and on and on and on. Does that relate to this whole subject of, you know, an ice weasel, which is, of course, a tip of the hat to Debian? Is there a reason the names are so interesting here? What's going on?
Well, yeah. So these are folks who are engaged in this kind of utopian project that's maybe, you could think of it as being built along the lines of Barlow's Declaration of Independence of Cyberspace, where they are walking away from mainstream society, walking away from a world where there isn't much place for like normal people anymore, because the 1% has all the robots it needs and has enough idle workers around to keep those few people who are needed to keep the robots running on their toes, because they could be replaced. And the rest of us are kind of surplus to requirements, and they wander off in this disaffected way to build this utopian parallel world. And, you know, when you think about the history of utopian parallel worlds, there's a lot of reinvention. People tend to take on new names. You know, I'm sure if I was to log into your IRC right now, it would be full of people with handles.
Absolutely.
And not so many real names.
Absolutely.
And, you know, that ability to like decide who you are, it's really key to a lot of people engaged in audacious things. You know, there's this thing that happens whenever we think about people who are, you know, loom large in our history, and we look at them, and it turns out that not only did they do this unusual and amazing thing in, you know, leading the March on Selma, or you know, inventing an amazing technology, they also have lots of other things that are atypical, some of which may not be so great, and some of which turn out to also be amazing considered separately. And I don't know. I mean, I'm not trying to say that we should just let great people get a walk when they're, you know, jerks. But I do think the fact that people who are grandiose enough to want to do something world-changing also are full of other weird ideas, that's not a coincidence. That it's weird enough to say, oh, yeah, the world is screwed up, so I'm going to make a better one. That we shouldn't be surprised when people who do that also have other things that are atypical about them.
We're talking with Cory Doctorow, his newest book, Walk Away. There's so much catching up I have to do with you. Last time we talked, you were living in the UK. You abandoned the UK for Southern California. I'm wondering if you're regretting that now.
Ha. Well, you know, we got out of the UK just ahead of Brexit, and we landed really just in time for Trump.
Good timing.
And, you know, if there's a lesson there, it's that we can't outrun whatever crisis we're in the middle of that history will later have a name for, that Walkaway is really a novel about the response to. That, you know, my friends in Hungary and in Poland and in the Philippines and even in Australia for years had been saying, oh, you know, you think that things are so sane and sensible there in the UK, and that we're all nuts where we are, and that our crazy, awful, extremist government with its bizarre policies and climate denial and whatnot, that those are that's some kind of indictment of our national character, as opposed to like an early warning sign of something going on across the world. Well, you just wait, right? It's coming for you too. And you know, I just actually just reviewed this book. Let me see if I can. I just put it on my shelf behind me. Oh, I don't know where I put it. The Canada Land Guide to Canada that was published by this guy, Jesse Brown, who's got this amazing Canada Land podcast. That's really a catalog of all the ways that Canada is not the reasonable, sane paradise that we think it is. It's just got great PR. And there's not really anywhere you can go to outrun these problems. There we go. The Canada Land Guide to Canada. And, you know, Jesse points out that, like, if looking great with your shirt off is a real qualification for leadership, then Putin would be the greatest leader the world had ever seen. And, you know, the fact that we have this charismatic leader in Canada does not mean that Canada is a place where we can ride out this weird global crisis that we're in the middle of. So one of the things Walkaway is supposed to be is an optimistic disaster novel. It's about the theory that what distinguishes a disaster from a catastrophe is not whether something wrong happens, because that just happens, right? You're going to have rising seas or belligerent neighbors or, you know, mutating microbes or a meteor strike, no matter how well organized your society is. So what really matters is not how well it works, but what happens when it fails. And Walkaway is a novel about people who, when things start to go wrong, pitch in to help each other instead of turning on one another. And also about the idea that elites in that moment tend to see not normal people banding together to make things better, but a mob in potentia that needs to be preemptively struck against. And that it is based on this amazing book by Rebecca Solnit, who's an East Bay writer there in Oakland, who wrote this book called Paradise Built in Hell. She's an historian, and she went and looked very closely at contemporaneous first-person accounts of what people did during some of history's great disasters, especially ones that are remembered as being times when people acted badly. And what she finds is that the people on the ground writing about it while it happened saw endless and amazing outpourings of nobility, but the people from a distance, and especially the rich and powerful, saw in this rebuilding great chaos, and they magnified any marginal incidents of bad behavior, of rioting or of looting or whatever, or made it up when there was none to be found. And that this is this thing that we remember about, you know, Katrina. We remember the rapes in the dome in Katrina, even though they've never been substantiated, and there's no reason to believe that there were ever rapes in the dome in Katrina. And what we don't remember is that in Katrina, the street gangs formed a kind of triage system that systematically sought out the most vulnerable, disabled people and elderly people, and made sure that they got preferential access to water and food and cooling because they were at risk of dying in the dome. And so I wanted to write a story where the tension doesn't come from people behaving badly, but from the certainty that people will behave badly, and that gets in the way of the people who are really behaving in the way that we'd always hoped we would in times of crisis.
Yeah, I think anybody who's been through a crisis, even a small crisis, sees people step up and really act human at our best. We all know that's the case. But the history of government, including our own, is the history of essentially the elites figuring out a way to keep a lid on the people, on the masses, so that they can continue to enjoy their elite lifestyle. And I take it that's what's going on in Walkaway.
Yeah, it's really about this phenomenon of elite panic. You know, the certainty that when the lights go out, the poors are going to come for you with a shotgun. You know, I think that makes for really exciting stories often. And I think that there's a corollary here to what I did with Little Brother. So part of the impetus for writing Little Brother was that I got really tired of stories, especially movies, but also novels, where all the tension came from computers acting in ways that didn't make any sense, right? That were really unbelievable, where we were asked to believe that computers would have cryptography that would just suddenly fail catastrophically all over the world, or that viruses were huge laughing ASCII art skulls that stole your files and cackled at you from your screen, or whatever. All this stuff that just doesn't make any sense, where everything is stored in the mainframe, right? As though mainframes were like where we put important stuff these days, as opposed to like those legacy systems that we haven't yet figured out how to turn off. And I thought, you know, instead of stories in which the constraints of computers are things that we ignore so that we can come up with some drama, what if we told stories where the constraints of computers were the thing that made the drama happen, the engine of the drama? And in the same way, if instead of saying that the thing that gives us drama is people who behave in this sort of unbelievable but narratively convenient, awful way in times of crisis, that gives us our kind of narrative drive. What if the narrative drive came from people behaving in exactly the way that we expect they would? You know, there's this kind of weird statistical illiteracy at work when people say most people are untrustworthy and bastards, because they also say, but not me, not my family, and not everyone I know. Those people are good people. And it seems really unlikely, if 99% of people are terrible people, that you would somehow have found the good ones, right? It's much more likely that the people that you know are,
yeah,
they're just representative samples. They're, right. You know, imperfect right. humans who, with our foibles. And so what about a story in which people are like kind of rigorously imperfect in the way that we all are? And the drama comes from that. People trying to help each other, not people turning on each other.
This is why I love Corey and I love his work, because he always has big ideas, but the big ideas are couched in immensely readable and fun writing. And so it's always a pleasure to read. You're a master of the cultural mashup, you know, in ways that kind of remind me a little of William Gibson, who, by the way, you've got the best log rolling I've ever seen in my life on the back of this book.
Yeah, I got some good quotes.
Holy cow. William Gibson says, "The darker the hour, the better the moment. For a rigorously imagined utopian fiction, Walkaway is now the best contemporary example I know of. It's utopia glimpsed after a fascinatingly extrapolated revolutionary struggle. A wonderful novel. Everything we've come to expect from Cory Doctorow and more." Edward Snowden says, "Walkaway reminds us the world we choose to build is the one we'll inhabit." Kim Stanley Robinson, Neal Stephenson. Neal Stephenson says, "You've authored the Bhagavad Gita of hacker, maker, burner, open source, Git, GNU, Wiki, 99% adjunct faculty, anonymous shareware, Thingverse, cypherpunk, LGBTBQIA, squatter, upcycling culture, and zipped it down into a pretty damn tight techno thriller with a lot of sex in it." Thank you, Neal Stephenson. And he wrote that with a fountain pen, I want to point out.
I'm sure he did. So Neal and I are going to be on stage in Seattle on the tour. And I'm going to be on stage with Snowden at the New York Public Library.
Nice.
Unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to hook up with Stan or Bill Gibson on this trip. They're both going to be out of town when I'm in their hometowns. But I'll probably appear with Stan this summer at Mysterious Galaxy in San Diego. I know we'll both be teaching the Clarion Workshop at UCSD at the same time this summer.
The highest praise was given many years ago to Werner Vinge, who everybody said, the public don't know him, but every science fiction writer adores him and loves him and is inspired by him. And I'd say, just from the back of this book, that's you're kind of the Werner Vinge.
Well, I hope the public knows me, too.
The public should know you, though. We're going to do our best to get the word out. It's great to have you back, Corey. We're going to take a break. Come back with more in just a second. Corey Doctorow, our guest. First, a word from Box.com. I'm a huge fan. I've been a Box.com subscriber. I think back, it started when one of the Linux distributions I was using had support in the file manager for Box.com. I thought, this is really cool. And ever since, I've had a Box. You know what Box.com is, right? It provides a single place where you can edit, comment, share, and approve files from any device. You could simplify your workflow. Centralize your documents, keep your team on track with Box. It's great for individuals, even better for business. Box.com. Always make sure you have the latest version on hand, making sure that it's easy to collaborate with your team. You can preview full documents in more than 120 file types. I think people don't know Box will do this. Not just PDF, but even like Photoshop, PSD, not downloading, previewing, which makes it really great on mobile. You'll receive real-time notifications when edits are made, so it's great for collaboration. And Box saves earlier versions in case you need to go back. Versioning is huge. Use the Box app to stay productive wherever you are. Send photos or videos from your iPhone or iPad directly to Box with Box Capture. Keep your desktop, web, and mobile content synced with Box Sync. Thousands of integrated apps to DocuSign. If you're in Realtor or you have documents, Google Docs, of course, Salesforce. And with Box.com, you can eliminate the number one security flaw, the thing I always talk about, don't send email attachments. You just share large files with team members, customers, external agencies securely and easily for them, easily for you, using a link or a custom URL. Control permissions, set expiration dates, secure files with password protection. You can even remotely log out a user and delete Box data on any lost or stolen device. I mean, this Box has really worked it out. This is the best way to do this. It's amazing. And incidentally, unlike some of these other services, you can meet your organization's content governance and compliance standards with Box. They're FedRAMP compliant, FIPS compliant, FINRA compliant, HIPAA compliant, and more. That is huge. Solve data residency requirements, because you can have your data stored anywhere in the world, Europe, Asia, Australia. Use Box platform to create apps that improve customer experiences and streamline business processes. They have plans for individuals. That's the one I have. They have business plans. That's the one we have at work. We have enterprise plans, too, for the big businesses. Look it, Box is the king. More than 41 million users, 59,000 businesses, 60% of the Fortune 500 trust Box to manage their content in the cloud. Stop relying on IT to build workflow. Box empowers users to take ownership of their work. And that's kind of the topic of the day today, isn't it? Transform the way your business collaborates and work is one with Box.com. We've got a 2-week trial waiting for you. B-O-X, Box.com. Maybe it's time to take another look if you've tried it before. I love it. This is an amazing product. Box.com. They really, it's like I hadn't used it in a while, and it's like, wow. Wow. This is not your daddy's Box. Cory Doctorow is our guest. Man, this guy moves in big circles. His newest novel, Walk Away, going to be a New York Times bestseller. It isn't yet because it comes out tomorrow as we record this. But, you know, I mean, Little Brother, Magic Kingdom. You have so many great books. And this fits right in there where, as I mentioned before, this is a book with a message, but great fiction. And a novel that moves at a rapid pace. I was up late last night.
Yeah, Mecca's fighting Zeppelins with railguns.
and a great cultural mashup too, which I love. So there's a lot of moments of, you know, cultural frisson as you go. Oh yeah. Anonymous. I love it. What is the time period? Do you establish that?
No, you know, I have never really wanted to pin down any of my books to a specific year. And I think that's done them well. You know, Little Brother, nominally, I wrote it around 2006. So nominally, it's set around 2008. But, you know, there's stuff in there that deliberately is meant to throw you off the trail of exactly what year. There's stuff that's deliberately anachronistic to make it hard to pin it to a year and to put it firmly in this kind of contrafactual universe that is not a a prediction, but a parable. And so I think science fiction... It's not really a predictive literature, but what science fiction does really well is you have all the writers writing all the futures. Everything that we can imagine is being written all the time. And then the editors and the public are plucking the works that seem to resonate with them out of that and kind of elevating them to prominence in our kind of discourse of ideas. And so it's a bit like natural selection, right? The writers are the mutations. We are, you know, coming up with randomly varied mutations on different ways of thinking about the future. And then the world is acting as a selective force, picking out the ones that kind of play like an open chord across all of our strings and tell us what our aspirations are, what our fears are. And that's why, you know, fiction can feel very prescient, and also why in a moment we can seem to have a whole bunch of books that are all about the same thing. It's not that it's impossible that Harry Potter would come out and become successful, and then a week later there'd be a bunch of Harry Potter-ish books on the shelf. What's happened is that the publishers have pulled out of their back catalog and out of their slush piles the things that they were thinking of or that they had easy to hand and brought them to the shelf. Because Harry Potter has proven itself to be successful. And so all the Harry Potter-like books that have been written or have been previously published suddenly end up on the shelf next to it.
Cory is, I guess, first and foremost a writer. I mean, according to Wikipedia, you started selling fiction when you were 17. Mm-hmm. But you're also an activist. Served for 4 years as a European Affairs Coordinator for the EFF. You spoke at the Hope Conference last July. I imagine you'll be doing that again soon. So you're an activist in the real world. One of the things that I in previous books, you've made them Creative Commons and a kind of open source. This one is not.
Yeah,
Tell me about that.
So the reasoning for Creative Commons was really threefold. One was that I felt that in a world in which it really only takes one click to get a book for free, whether or not it's been CC'd, that I wanted to find a way to incentivize people to voluntarily buy the book, that that all payments are fundamentally voluntary because you could just take the book for free if you didn't feel like paying for it, and it's no one would ever catch you.
Right.
And, you know, that seems like pretty obvious to anyone who uses the internet. And one was that I wanted people to understand that all of the things that I do when I write, which is to take other works and, you know, file their serial numbers off and mash them up and make new works out of them, that was part of the legitimate tradition. And one was that I really wanted to make sure that people enjoyed the full range of freedoms that came with print books. You know, I have books on these shelves that are books that I've taken with me back and forth across the ocean as I move from Canada to Central America to San Francisco to London, back to LA, back to London, now back to LA again. And, you know, books that came to me through my father, books that came to me through dear friends, books that I bought used, books that I bought new, books that are, you know, hundreds of years old. Here's one of my favorites is the old Punch.
I subscribed to that when I was a kid. When I was a teenager, I loved Punch.
So, you know, 19th century art literature, and that, you know, we have this beautiful old tradition of books that when I say old, I mean like not just older than, you know, modern publishing, but like older than copyright and printing.
Right.
That has with a set of rights that go to book owners that are separate from the set of rights that go to publishers or writers. And that by fiat, with the advent of the digital book, five publishers declared that 7,000 years of norms around ownership of books had been wiped off the slate, and that now we had a new deal where you were a licensor of the book and that your rights were totally constrained. And I think CC is an amazing way to signal that. My publisher
same way.
Well, they became less patient with CC.
Right.
And my views about it. And in particular, it was really hampering my foreign agents' ability to sell my books overseas.
Right.
That was because with my publisher, I could sit down and talk it through with them and get them kind of on board. But, you know, with my Italian publisher, my French publisher, my German publisher, I'm not in the room, right? This is my agents, foreign sub-agents, going to Bologna, going to Frankfurt, these big book fairs, and selling to the one very fluent English speaker from that publisher who's come to negotiate with all the English language editors. And, you know, expecting these guys who are selling this catalog, this binder of hundreds of English language writers to, in that 25-minute meeting with someone from a big publisher from Portugal to get into CC with them was unrealistic.
Yeah.
And so it's not that it didn't happen, but it ended up with a lot of confusion and a lot of, you know, firefighting and whatnot.
Even like Paulo Coelho couldn't – that example wasn't enough to kind of open their eyes.
Yeah, it just wasn't.
Yeah.
But what I came to realize – was that there were other ways to accomplish these goals. I could continue to use CC for independently published work and for my personally published work. So, you know, I write between 5 and 20 short essays, some of them very substantial, on Boing Boing every day, all of them CC'd. I do that 5 to 7 days a week and have done it for 15 years. So it's not like I don't continue to publish on under Creative Commons. I just have changed, you know, one corner of what I work in terms of its relationship to CC. And I still am a great believer in CC, but, you know, there are these other ways of expressing these preferences. So for one thing, all of my publishers are DRM free, and that's not something I'm ever going to waver on. You mentioned that I used to work for EFF. I'm actually back at EFF. I've been back now for about a year and a half as a special consultant on a single project called Apollo 1201, whose 10-year mission is to kill all the DRM in the world forever.
Nice.
And so all my books are DRM free. And that means that if you violate the license terms that are imposed because of stupid licensing things, there is no automatic mechanism for enforcement against you. You do get, you know, the thing about DRM is that breaking DRM is itself an offense with no fair use defense that the courts have found so far. And so if you have to break DRM in order to exercise your fair use, you are already in trouble. No DRM, you get to argue for your rights. So I get to claw that back. And in terms of fair use, and in terms of the other uses you might make of the work, CC is nice, and it's nice to have some like affirmative element where the writer intervenes and says, I affirm that these rights that have been yours in copyright and by common tradition for thousands of years are still yours, but we shouldn't be depending on the voluntary surrendering of these ridiculous rights grabs in order to get there. You know, our pole star shouldn't be voluntary licensing. It should be the unassailable, inalienable right of the reader to remix, to you know, continue in this literary tradition the way I have, the way other writers always have. And so for me, my pole star is like Supreme Court cases like The Wind Ungone, where the Margaret Mitchell Estate sued the author of a retelling of Gone with the Wind from the perspective of the enslaved people. And the Supreme Court found that taking all the characters and all the plot elements and using them in a new transformative way, even if the author objected, was not an offense, that copyright allowed that, that was part of the free expression bargain in copyright. And so it's kind of a tautology that the authors who don't mind if you don't remix their books don't mind if you remix their books. What I'm interested in is what about the authors who do mind in a way that hobbles free speech? That's the really, that's the sharp issue, right? Not the woke, cool, hip writers who are like down with remix. It's the whole world of material that we've always historically remixed, whose remixability has been compromised by these new norms. And CC is great for allowing people to push back against those norms, but it should be the floor on what we remix and not the ceiling. And so the way I reconciled myself to this and discussing it with my publisher was by asserting that we could talk very publicly about the rights of people to remix. We could have no DRM. And then finally, that I could field my own ebook store that was DRM free, that would make me a retailer for my books, so that even with the books that are CC licensed, you can choose to pay for them. And with the books that aren't CC licensed, well, you know, you still have a choice because you can go and get them for free somewhere else on the internet, so you can choose to pay zero. And in my ideal world, you could choose to pay a number that was between zero and full fare. But, you know, the world is an imperfect place. And at the very least, what I can do is give you a way to buy those books with no licensing terms. So when you buy that book from me, the license is you can do the things copyright lets you do, and you can't do the things copyright forbids. And that's the full entire license spectrum. You don't have to waive your rights to walk in the door of my ebook store. And, you know, I get a lot of email from people who are like, I like your books, but I don't want to give money to Jeff Bezos or some other big company. How do I do that? Well, you buy them from me. I remit to my publisher. And
so you pay a royalty back to the publisher? In
effect? Yeah. So I get the retail split off the top. I get the 30% retail split off the top, and I get the 25% retail split off the back end. It's almost 50%. Which is not coincidentally, it's what the Authors Guild thinks we should be getting for our ebooks. So it's a way to get the money that the Authors Guild, who are often quite reactionary about copyright and ebooks, it's a thing that we can agree on and a way to make it happen without, you know, asking the publishers to change the standard deal for ebook royalties, which like they would rather drink a warm jug of spit every morning for breakfast than change the standard deal. But this is a way to give my readers an identical ebook, but to do it through a mechanism that I control that allows me to also sell into every territory. So I have a different publisher in the US and the UK.
Right.
You go to the wrong website, you know, not if you're in the US and the UK, but maybe if you're in Canada, you'll guess the wrong website. And Amazon US will just say, Amazon UK in the case of Canada would say, just buzz off. You're not allowed to buy this book, right? Well, like if you're sitting there with your money in your hand, I want to take your money. And so I can sell into every territory. I figure out, based on where you live, who gets the remittance from my publisher. And so you don't have to figure out what my Baroque commercial arrangements are in order to read my books, which is also a thing we've never asked people to do in the world of print books.
Yeah.
So it takes a lot of the dumb, inefficient, crappy stuff about buying ebooks, and it throws it away. and it replaces it with something that is foundationally fair, that allows the writer and the reader to have a stronger relationship, and that ensures that the reader's rights are intact. And so where Creative Commons was a way for me to incentivize people to believe that they were getting a fair deal when they got my books, this is a way to do that too, that keeps me and my publisher and my agent all working with the same set of incentives and the same alignment. And you know, you were showing me earlier that you have my self-published ebook collection or short story collection there, yeah, with a little help.
Yeah.
And I self-published that short story collection. I made to a first approximation about $30,000 on it, which is about what I would make if I had done it with a traditional publisher. So right. I can definitely make as much money. No, I make a lot more from novels. I make, you know, without like naming numbers, an order of magnitude more than that easily with novels.
Interesting.
But it took an enormous amount of work to make that book happen.
Absolutely,
and that was a time that I did not spend writing other books.
Right.
And so after doing that, you know, if I had made 10x that, if I'd made $300,000 on a short story collection that I self-published, I would have said, yeah, absolutely, I'm going to tithe 10 or 15% of my writing time from now on to being a self-publisher. But I didn't. Right. And I think I was well situated to have done that. And I failed to. And not that the experiment was a failure, but that it showed me that I could better spend my time working with a publisher who specializes in getting my books in front of my audience, with an agent who can bring that book to publishers I would never meet all over the world. And that that combination was so powerful and gets my books read by so many more people and gives me so much more time to write, that it made sense for me to find a way to publish that aligned all of our incentives. And I do regret that it's not CC licensed. Like, I'm not going to lie. But I also feel like I'm accomplishing many of the same equities that I'd hoped for. And that that what I'm not going to get into is that was one of my great impetuses for getting into CC licenses, is I'm not going to get into a situation where my artistic business model or my copyrights become an excuse for more internet censorship, more internet surveillance, where someone sues a fan or an innovator because of my copyrights. That's never going to be part of the calculus because of the way that I've constructed the rest of my publishing business, even without CC.
And the reason I asked you, I wanted to find out how you felt, if you felt that these experiments had failed, and now this makes a lot of sense. You know, you want to lead, you want to create change, but you can't lead the parade so fast that they're left behind and you're marching alone around the corner. So you got to bring people along with you, and sometimes they don't move at the speed we'd all like, but that's fine. Have you ever sat down with talk to somebody like Ursula K. Le Guin and tried to persuade her of your point of view?
You know, I did have a conversation like that with Ursula, and it didn't end well. Yeah. And I think she has been quite angry at me ever since.
She's one of the most vocal Authors Guild proponents.
It makes me a bit sad because I'm an enormous fan of her work, and I wish that we could see eye to eye on this. I think maybe if we had a longer talk, it would have worked out better, but it actually went very poorly. I have had this talk with other authors who we've been very cordial, and it's ended well, and I think we both learned from each other. A good example of that from the Authors Guild is James Glick, who wrote Chaos Making of a New Science.
Love
and
James
the Information,
Glick.
Yeah. And his new book is the time travel book. He is a wonderful, wonderful writer, and he and I, we have a lot of common ground. And, you know, a lot of what he sees as copyright's benefit is from a kind of labor management split. And I think that he's right, that one of the great tools we have in terms of copyright's enforceability is a club with which we on the supply side can beat the intermediaries like our publishers with, and that that tool can be very useful to us. And, you know, this reminds me of like when I was a baby writer. You know, all the writers I met when I was coming up told me that copyright was the most important thing, and that any copyright I surrendered was something that would be used to beat me up by my publishers. And they're right that copyright is a useful tool to mediate my relationship with my publishers, but it doesn't make it a useful tool to mediate my relationship with my audience. And, you know, you have never had to know a single solitary thing about copyright to read, lend, share a book, right? And if we believe that we are going to somehow get the entire reading public to give the tiniest little crap about our weird esoteric industrial regulation as a condition of being entertained by us,
yeah,
we are sadly mistaken.
Yeah.
Right? And like, we can't, right? Because copyright is this super recondite technical set of rules for you know, this very complicated industry with a lot of moving parts. And the idea that you could like build a copyright system that was on the one hand, like complicated, technical, and nuanced enough that Universal could use it when they licensed Harry Potter from Warner and built the Universal Harry Potter theme park that's around the corner from me here. But that like a kid in her mom's basement around the corner from me here could use those same rules to navigate her Harry Potter fanfic. It's ridiculous. Right. You know, even if she were like the Doogie Howser of law and got a JD at 12, no one at Warner's is going to answer the phone when she calls them up for a license. Right. They got better things to do with their time. And so, you know, that is just like it's a stupid fairy tale we tell ourselves that someday we'll use copyright to mediate our relationships with our audience. And that doesn't mean that we won't have some rules. And they may not, they may even be legal rules, right? Mostly they're normative rules, the things that readers and writers use to mediate their relationships. You know, Stephen Bruce says telling a writer he wrote a bad book is like telling him he's got an ugly kid, even if it's true, he's done everything he could to prevent it. It's too late now. So we have lots of normative rules about what we should do, writers and readers. But the idea that we'll use the same framework that we use as an industry is like wrong on its face and totally bonkers.
We're talking to Cory Doctorow. New novel comes out April 25th. We'll talk about how you can get it. There are other ways to get it. Of course, it's on Amazon in just a moment. More with Cory in a bit. I noticed Cory's very well coiffed. Love the shirt. And he's well shaved, as am I. I don't know how Cory does it, but I can tell you how I do it. Harry's, for guys who want a great shave at a fraction of the price for years, decades really, one big razor company has relentlessly increased prices and reaped immense profits at the expense of their customers. But Harry's was founded to change all that by two best friends, Jeff and Andy. They said, this is it. You go to a drugstore, they lock up the blades. They're so expensive. We don't think that's fair. So they started their own razor company to give people what they deserve, a great shave at a fair price. They even bought the factory that makes the blades in Germany, the best factory in the world for making razor blades, because they wanted to sell direct to you. And now I am a happy Harry's subscriber, and you should be too. They've got shave sets to get you started. As little as $15, a weighted ergonomic handle. You get 5 precision blades. You get the lubricating strip. Yes, they have the trimmer blade right on the top there for getting right under your nose or in those hard-to-reach areas. Rich lathering shave gel or the shave cream. I like the cream. Travel blade cover. But we got a new deal, which is really awesome. Instead of buying the Harry's kit, they're going to get you a kit free. You just cover shipping when you sign up. That's right. Try Harry's for free. This is new. Just pay shipping. This is a $13 value. You get a little sample of the shave gel. It's the kind of the starter kit. But, you know, we were talking about DRM. Razor companies have a form of DRM because their blades, you know, the connection to the handle is patented, can't be copied, right? So you have to buy, you get the handle, you have to buy their blades. So Harry's, I mean, they're stuck. They need to give you a handle, but they decide this is the best way to do it. We'll give it to you. You get you started. Get that subscription. Get the blades you need on a schedule. You set the schedule that works for how often you shave. Get the shave cream or the gel you need, again, on schedule. They even have that nice bracer, you know, after shave. I can't believe they're doing this. Start your subscription free and with a free trial right now. Harry's. HARRYS.com/triangulation. You'll look great, you'll smell great, and you'll save a bunch. HARRYS.com/triangulation. Cory Doctorow is my guest. Walk Away, the new novel published by Tor. And you said you're selling ebook versions. Is that at Craphound?
Yeah, craphound.com. We launched that store, you know.
Which is down for maintenance as we're doing.
We launch it tomorrow.
As we're doing this.
Is that right?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Well, my hackers must be hacking it low even as we speak.
Oh, Lord,
yeah,
Cory.
So tomorrow, the Fair Trade ebook store launches on Craphound. You'll be able to get it there. You can still pre-order signed copies from Barnes & Noble in the U.S. and Forbidden Planet in the U.K. I signed 3,000 Tippin sheets then bound into a special little edition. And I think there's a few left in Barnes & Noble's warehouse. Most of them were pre-ordered, though. And then I'm in about 30 cities in the U.S., Canada, and the U.K. And so you can come to one of those events, or you can also probably pre-order for most of those booksellers. I'm a recovering bookseller, and I know whenever we had an author in, we would happily have people call in ahead and give us a credit card number and ask to have a book signed and personalized that we'd ship to them after the event.
Let's do that. Let's help those mm-hmm. independent booksellers who are still having
really
authors in
stores.
And speaking yeah. and things like that. And a chance to see, where is does Crap Hat have your schedule too? Because, boy, people should get yeah. a chance to see you and Neil Stevens.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, the chance to see those.
If you just Google Cory Doctorow Walkaway Tour, you'll see it too.
Okay.
And I'll be, if you're airing this on Tuesday, I think you said you air this on Tuesday. Is that right?
We're doing it on Monday. People are watching now live, but we okay. put it out immediately after. So, yeah, it comes out late
oh,
Monday.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, Tuesday, I'll be at Roman's Books in Pasadena with John Scalzi oh. and Amber Benson,
oh.
who reads both of our audiobooks. And so she'll be on stage too. Will Wheaton also reads both of our audiobooks.
Nice.
He unfortunately had to cancel. He had to go to Germany. But we'll have some of the production people from Skyboat Media will be there, and it's going to be a great little fiesta.
I have, as you pointed out, I have With a Little Help. Is that still available? Can people still buy this?
It is. I have like, you can see up in the corner there maybe, I have like 6 copies left.
This is the hardcover, number 72 out of 250.
Yeah.
And these are expensive, but you get this, there's a lot in it that's kind of interesting. Somebody's lecture notes, whose are these? A page from my high school lecture notes, spring 2009. But it's fun stuff.
I can Google that. I can figure that out.
And then on here, I love the front. Here we go. I'll show it to the right camera. Is an SD card. And you got many people, including me, to read. This is a collection
yeah,
of short stories.
Right.
To read short stories. And you can get the audio on here with your SD card, which is fantastic.
Thank you.
So tell me about the audiobook. You don't use Audible because
sure.
of DRM, right?
Because of DRM. So I had previously been with Random House Audiobooks, and now I'm with Blackstone. But because the Audible won't carry my books unless I put DRM on them, the market is pretty small, and they don't want to invest the kind of money that I really want to see for a big book like Walkaway. And so I self-produced this audiobook, which will also be on sale on my website. It'll be on Downpour, which is Blackstone's DRM-free audiobook store. And it was produced at Skyboat. The readers, as I said, included Will Wheaton, Amber Benson, also Amanda Palmer, and Myron Willis,
fun.
And all these wonderful, wonderful readers, Gabrielle DeQueer, who also directed it. And then I just took delivery of these. I got 500 audiobooks on little business cards with USB snap-outs.
Oh, that's so cute.
How does this work?
I thought at first it was a cassette you held up. I thought, how retro.
Yeah, right. Here we go. So there it is. So
nice.
It's a little USB stick, and it's got the FLAX and MP3s
yeah.
of the whole audiobook.
Nice.
So I'll probably eventually sell that on my website, but I made 500 of them for the tour, and I'm just going to sell them from the tour while I go around. And then we'll see about actually retailing them to the wider public. But please don't send me an email asking me while I'm on the tour to find a post office and an envelope and send you one, because I can't do that.
So let's see. What else? There's so much to talk about. You're back with EFF. I think that's exciting.
Yeah.
I've been doing that for about a year. But writing is still your full-time.
Yeah, it really is. I'm writing a third little brother novel right now.
Oh, good.
Called Crypto Wars.
Those are great.
It's a novel for adults. So the other two, Homeland and Little Brother, are both YA novels, which
designed to wake up the young people.
That's right. Well, and people get confused because they're like, I'm an adult and I enjoyed Little Brother.
Oh, it's
and,
great.
And I think what they're missing that it's not a symmetrical relationship. So
right.
all YA novels are cool for adults to read. But like as a parent, there's some stuff in adult novels that are not cool for kids to read. And so it's, you know, this is a novel that's structured like a YA novel. It's very zippy, one point of view, goes really fast. But it's it deals with more adult themes than Little Brother does. And that's not to say that there aren't young people who are mature enough to handle it. But my like little litmus test for YA when I think about writing a YA novel is if a YA librarian gave this to a kid without knowing anything about the kid or their parents, could they get fired for
right.
it? And if the answer is yes, then it's probably an adult novel.
It ain't the kid. It's let's be honest. It's the parents.
Okay, so yes and no, right? Like, I'm a parent, and so as I mentioned at the start of this, my daughter is now reading some of my books. So we were at the LA Times Festival of Books yesterday, and my kid, while I was doing a signing, she went over, she picked up a copy of Makers, and Makers has got some blistering sex scenes in them. And my kid is 9, and yeah. She said, okay. Daddy, is this a good book for me to read? And I said, it's really not. Like, not that, it would probably just go over her head for the most part, but it's not age appropriate. And like, I think the right place for that decision to be made is by, you know, the parent, right? And by the kid, you know, by the parent and the kid working together to kind of establish their limits.
How has having poesy changed your outlook on life? Having a child really can change how you feel.
Yeah, it really does. So there's an immediate change in my work style and in the kinds of work I enjoy and do. So the thing about my work style that immediately happened when the kid was born is that I became 100 times more efficient with my time. That, like, basically slack moments, I pounce on them and put them to good use, because there are so few slack moments once you're a parent, right? And so that's the first thing. And the second thing is that I became incapable of enjoying media in which the tension arose from children being in danger.
I had that experience as well. I think every parent does. It just changes that. You can't do it. It's like,
yeah.
I can't watch this.
And, you know, I like to lean into that stuff. And someday I will write a story where that is where that's the thing, right? Because that's, you know, sitting down at the keyboard and opening a vein, that's how you write, you know? And
wow.
I definitely want to find out how to do that. I mean, imagine a short story of little brother from the perspective of his parents. You know, that would be a child in peril story. And it would be a very dramatic and intense one.
I like that. So you challenge yourself. That's how you challenge yourself. You try to write about the stuff that's difficult and painful and challenging. Yeah.
Yeah, that's how you know you're in touch with something important. You know, and not to be just like visceral for viscera's sake, not just gore, but to like get at the emotional stuff that is really where your fears, your secret fears and anxieties and hopes are, and to really push at it. That's the stuff that when you read it feels raw and true, I think.
Awesome. I love that. Cory Doctorow is our guest. The new book, Walk Away, is available April 25th, not only at bookstores. In fact, here's what you do. You find out where Cory Doctorow's Walk Away tour is. You call that bookstore, you order an autographed copy, and then you go see him if it's near you.
That would be pretty great.
Wouldn't that be awesome if everybody did that?
I'd be a very happy man.
You can also get the audio version at craphound.com. That's not up yet, but it will be up soon.
And it'll be at Downpour as well.
And Downpour. I didn't know about Downpour. This is an eye-opener.
Yeah, it's great. And it's got everything that Audible has except the books that they produce and don't allow distribution on. And I think even some of those are now there. Like, I think I saw some of Scalzi's books, which are Audible produced.
Well, they have Lincoln and the Bardo, which was the most amazing audio production book I've ever heard in my life. And they have it. So I feel like, Audible is still a sponsor. Love Audible. And I am grateful that they do the productions that they do, because they're really bringing back science fiction that has never been provide an audiobook, and thank goodness that they're doing that. But it's nice to see that there's another choice that's like on MP3 that I could put it anywhere.
Right.
Yeah.
And for the record, if anyone from Audible is listening to this, I would love to have my books on Audible. Just make them DRM free.
Yeah.
And I will be like, because I'm a huge fan of what Audible has done, right? In terms of like,
absolutely,
as you said, bringing back all this work. You know, Stephen Bruce's books are Audible exclusive, and he is one of my favorite writers, and they are such good productions, and I really wish that I could get them, but I don't own a device that'll play Audible stuff.
Yeah.
And particularly, you know, I do all my audiobook listening, because I swim every day. I have a bad back. That's why I keep squirming here in front of your camera. And I swim every day. And I
thought it was the shirt, to be honest with you.
Yeah, that's right. It's Beta brand. I love Beta brand. But they, no, it's the, So I listened to it on this like underwater audiobook, MP3 player.
Nice.
And that's how I get through all my audiobooks. And it's like, boy, it's like a literal lifesaver, because I couldn't swim for an hour a day if I didn't have something to distract me.
Yes.
And if I didn't swim for an hour a day, I would be in so much pain.
Yes.
So it's a real lifesaver, but I can't I have to buy MP3s.
Yeah, last time we talked many years ago, you were talking about the process of ripping audiobooks and converting. You still write on a Linux machine?
I do, yeah. I'm talking to you on my latest ThinkPad, which is the X270. They have such awesome names.
Still ThinkPad. Still doing a ThinkPad. I love it. Yeah, I'll never forget beat-up ThinkPad you brought to one of our tapings that I had never seen anything in such bad shape. It was like...
Well, I'll tell you the amazing secret of ThinkPads. This is why people buy them who are in the know, is that the old IBM Global Services, which is now a division of Lenovo as well, but still run very separately, will, for $75 a year, sell you an on-site worldwide warranty where literally you break your ThinkPad anywhere anyone ever bought an IBM mainframe, which is where the Global Services offices are. And within 24 hours, a technician shows up at your hotel room, at your house, at your office, and fixes your laptop on the desk.
Whoa.
And, you know, the number of times that, like, I had my laptop fixed in a hotel room in Mumbai. Yeah.
That's a lifesaver.
So, yeah, I buy a ThinkPad every year. When I quit smoking, my doc said, you know, you need to have a reason to quit smoking that isn't not getting cancer in 40 years, because when you want a cigarette next week, the 40-year benefit is not going to be immediate enough. And I realized, you know, I was spending two laptops a year on cigarettes, right, from the worst companies in the world. So I told myself, you quit smoking,
a year now.
You can buy a guilt-free laptop every year for the rest of your life.
By the way,
every year I buy a laptop.
You look fantastic. You've kept the weight off. Your body hacking has worked. You look like you're in the best health you've ever been in.
Oh,
you look
fantastic. That's nice of you to say. Thank you. Well, the swimming really helps.
We've got to wrap it up, so I'm going to do one more commercial, and then I want to ask you about the dedication.
Cory
Doctorow is our guest. Crap Hound is back up. Your hackers got the message. You can go there and get versions of all of his books and support him. But again, support those independent bookstores, too, because that's a great service they're providing to their communities. Bringing in people like Cory is great. We'll have more in just a moment. You know, I have to remember next time to bring this in. I always like to bring in props for the show. I still have my original Square Stripe Reader, the dongle, way back when Square first started up. I thought this was the greatest idea ever. And even though I don't take credit cards, like I don't sell anything, I immediately sent for the dongle because I thought this is cool. And I would go around to friends and say, give me a buck, you know, charge it. Because it was so cool. It plugged into the audio jack on my iPhone. There it is. They still do that, by the way. It's still offered for free. It's the best way to take credit cards. It's a free MagStripe reader. They do have the new Square reader because, you know, first of all, Apple dropped the headphone jack. And nowadays, people want chip and pin, right? You tap, they want NFC payments or the chip cards. So they have a new reader. It's $49, but it works with iOS over Bluetooth LE, Android as well. You don't have to worry about a headphone jack. And it makes it really easy for people to just tap and pay. And then you slip your iPad into the Square stand, and you've got a complete point-of-sale system. This is really amazing. I love Square. Square.com/triangulation. Now, what's really cool... the services you get from Square. Square basically makes it possible for you to take credit cards, even if you work in people's homes. If you're a handyman or you set up audio visual systems, you can. And customers love it because they get this email receipt with a map that says where they paid for. I mean, it's really fantastic. You'll love it because you can take every major credit card, and the rate is straightforward, simple, and very low. No matter what kind of card, 2.75% for swipe, dip, or tap. For every card, if you want to do keyed-in transactions, 3.5% plus 15 cents per transaction. And if you do a lot of business, you know, Square will create a custom pricing package for you, too. No hidden fees. There are no penalties. There's no commitment. You just pay for what you use. That's why I sent away for this Stripe reader. I mean, that means you don't have to set up a merchant account or anything. You can take credit cards right then and there. And for a flat rate, they pay out fast, within 1 to 2 business days. If you need on-demand deposits, they can do that too for just 1% of the total deposit amount. You also get just automatically $250 in free chargeback protection, which is awesome. For you as a merchant, you get a Square dashboard. You can check on it on your PC or on the iOS app, see historical and real-time sales data. You can track inventory even. You can send marketing campaigns because it interfaces with all sorts of, like QuickBooks and Weebly, BigCommerce. So if you've got a website with BigCommerce, you can use Square, create loyalty programs. It is fantastic. And the API, and I mention this because I know a lot of you are geeks, the API is so good, it's very easy to write your own custom code if you want as well. Square provides top-level security, great customer support, and that's all built in. That's free of charge. See how Square works for you and your business, or just for fun. Then you can have, you know, you can go to dinner and you get friends to give you money with their credit cards. If you sign up now, you'll get free processing and your first $500 in sales. Wait a minute, what? Oh, that's cool. If you go to square.com/triangulation, free processing on your first $500 in sales. Some terms apply. square.com/triangulation. And we thank Square for their support of this show. Our great sponsors make it possible for us to give you this show DRM free. And pass it around and give it to your friends and tell your friends. We're having fun with Corey. Before we began our conversation, Corey and I talked a little bit about the challenges of travel, about him moving from the UK to the US, and we didn't want to throw that away. So here's a little bit of bonus material in today's Triangulation. Enjoy.
We're going to buy a house, and you can get dark fiber lit up. It's like $1,500. Yeah.
That's so awesome.
When we moved to LA, I Googled it, and there's companies that will come and light up your fiber for like $1,500, and then they charge you, you know, normal like $70 a month loop.
Is it fiber to the curb? Where does the fiber terminate?
I don't know.
Yeah, maybe that's going to be it's the last mile that's going to be the tricky part.
But it's gigabit, right? So I assume it comes to the door.
You might have Sonic down there. I wonder. Sonic's in many of these areas. We have 10 gigabit in the studio, symmetric.
Wow. Wow, where are you?
Petaluma, Northern California, but Sonic's up here. And I don't know who laid the fiber. I don't think Sonic laid who laid the fiber originally? I don't know. But this was Telecom Valley, you know, for a while.
Sure.
So
sure.
There's fiber out here. We're in a kind of a office park.
And, right.
And everybody here has fiber. And we made a deal with Sonic for 10 gigabit, which is a little ridiculous, but...
And you know, nice. You got it, flaunt it, right? too rich, too thin, or too fast.
Yeah. Well, it's good for our editors because they have to upload big files, and they spend a lot of time waiting for files to upload. So having no machine can go faster than a gigabit in here, but even having a gigabit is nice for them.
Yeah, sure.
Makes a big difference.
You've got to have some pretty heavy-duty routing stuff on the back end if you've got like 10 gigabits.
Yeah, I don't know what Russell's doing. I mean, when we said, Russell, we're going to have our IT guy, when we're going to have 10 gigabits, he said, well, nobody's going to be able to take advantage of that. I said, I know, but we're distributing it, so everybody will have better speeds.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know. He must have, obviously, has some sort of optic termination.
My server's hosted in a cage in Toronto at the big internet exchange at Torix, which is, you know, 10 gigabits plus. And so I will often, if I need to move files around really quickly, transfer them, I'll log into the shell, you know, wget them or curl them or whatever, and then download them at my leisure doing resumable downloads from there to my laptop as I move around the world.
That's a good idea. You should probably do, you know, have some sort of syncing tool there so you could have a common directory and all of that.
Yeah, I never really managed to make sync work very well, mostly because a lot of those, like I use Thunderbird, so my mail spools are all like in the hundreds of megabytes range.
Yeah,
and so you add one email to your inbox, and now you have to resync 300 gigabytes of blob.
You have an IMAP server, so you're fine that way, right?
I mean, no, I don't use IMAP.
Why not? Oh, now I'm going to find out why IMAP's bad. What do you use?
Harsher, mellow. I still use POP. So I use POP for a lot of reasons.
Oh, you don't want to leave your mail on the server.
That's it, right? Yeah. So, like, first of all, Electronic Privacy Act says that any file on a server for more than 90 or 180 days
they
is
changed
considered
that.
Abandoned.
They changed that.
In California, not federally.
Yeah, federally. Well, maybe it was only California.
Yeah, it was just California. All the attempts to modernize that have failed. That and also whenever you hear stories about people being breached, it's all like we then breached them and we had access to 10 years worth of their email. And that's how we were able to so comprehensively screw them over.
Right.
If you crack my email, you get everything I've got since the last time my computer was connected to the internet.
Right. That's
and then
all.
Finally, it lets me do things like carry a limited version of my email across borders and then cheerfully allow border guards to get that data.
Here, half my account. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I might have to rethink this whole thing.
It's tough. It's a tough workflow, you know, and like my wife is always like, so what are do you remember the details of that party we're invited to next week? And I'm like, yeah, when I get home, I'll look at my laptop and find out what those details are, because she's that used to searching Gmail on her phone. Right.
That is a convenience, I must admit.
Yeah.
But now that we're finding out what Unroll Me was doing, your point is really well taken, right?
Yeah.
Because as soon as you sign up for Unroll Me, they have everything going, you know, back to when you started using Gmail.
I have a colleague at the Media Lab who works for the Einstein Institute, which is this nonviolent political protest research institute. And she says that her philosophy is that you should assume that if your adversary has a capability, that they'll use it.
Right. That's fair.
And so, you know, when you look at kind of what the surveillance and control opportunities are with technology, a lot of our fallback is assuming that the law will be obeyed, or that the law will be sensible, or, you know, that if the law is broken, we'll catch the lawbreakers before they can make mischief. And if you take away those assumptions and assume the law will be routinely broken, and that there'll be no consequences for the people who do it, and that after it's broken, whatever they accomplish through breaking it will go on, then you really quickly get to a point where you're like, no, I should just not leave this file on a server. I should not have my, you know, I'm just about to go and purge all my Twitter DM history before I start traveling across borders on this tour. So I can log people into my Twitter if they say you can't come into my country unless you show me what's in your Twitter account.
You don't have dual citizenship. You're still Canadian?
I do.
Oh, you do?
I'm Canadian and British, not Canadian and American.
Canadian and British. Oh, so you're screwed.
Yeah, but I have a green card.
No, that doesn't help.
Yeah, no, it doesn't help. Well, it helps a little, right? I have more.
It's better than not.
They can't just refuse me entry. What they did to green card holders during the Muslim ban chaos was they said, we demand that you surrender your green card voluntarily, which, you know, is a highly specialized definition
demand
of voluntary, right? But when you voluntarily surrender your green card, then all bets are off. There's also a thing that when you're crossing, if you are in border detention, whether or not you're an American, and you want your legal representative to visit you, it is at the Border Patrol's, at the Border Protection Agency's discretion, unless there's this form called something like a G25. And it has to be, again, if they're not going to have any discretion over it, it has to be on green paper. And you have to sign it and give it to your lawyer before you cross the border, because the lawyer has to present it at the border to gain access to you. And so, you know, there's a lot of this stuff that's just silly and kind of
form.
It's predicated on the idea that
people.
Yeah, well, but it's predicated on the idea that the border guards won't be unreasonable, right? Because this is all stuff that just like having the magic incantation of the green paper in the right form and in advance is only in the, like, heretofore extremely unlikely event that someone from the Border Patrol denies someone in detention access to their legal representative.
Right.
And now we're like, well, what do we do if the discretion is exercised by people whose discretion we don't trust? This is one of the reasons that I found myself very frustrated with British politics, is a lot of British politics is predicated on the idea of providing discretion to the political class and to administrators, and then assume that they will exercise that discretion wisely.
Right.
And it's so wrong, you know, like in a world where GCHQ like kidnaps Libyan dissidents and sends them to Gaddafi to be tortured, like we shouldn't be leaving governments at their discretion.
Well, you know, and that's a very American point of view, so that's interesting. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, that was the whole point of the whole point of our Constitution was not that it's being honored, but was don't trust the government. Make sure that they have plenty of restrictions and limitations. The dedication in this for Eric Stewart and Aaron Schwartz, first days, better nations we fight on. Of course, Aaron Schwartz, I know the name. I don't know the name Eric Stewart.
So Eric, he was one of my very best friends. And the same year that Eric died, we called him Possum Man. He was a hacker. We lived together. He was, when he was about 11, he devised a way of visualizing up to seven dimensions in a three-dimensional space. And he spent like basically the rest of his life writing low-level graphics routines to help people do these multidimensional visualizations. When we lived together when I was 17, he was doing this on a 486 in assembler. And he went to bed one night, never woke up. Mm. He just had an undiagnosed blood clot in his brain. And just, you know, in his early 40s, he's a couple of years older than me, just never woke up. And really one of my best friends and someone very committed to fundamental justice in the same way that Aaron was. And they met once. They met at an emerging technologies conference, an O'Reilly eTech conference. And Possum, he founded this thing called Anarchist U that was a wiki-organized free school that had like 80 chapters around the world where people got together to teach each other. So you would propose a curriculum on a wiki, and the potential students would like edit the wiki until they found a syllabus that they could all agree on. And then you would find a place and you'd meet for 10 classes. And it went really well. I haven't checked in on it lately. I know he had a partner in it that was doing well. And I became his data conservator when he died. Mm. So he died with his computer on and his hard drives unencrypted. They because it was his computer was on, his drives were all mounted.
Right.
So I flew to Toronto with a terabyte hard drive and copied off his entire lifetime of data. And we don't know what to do with it yet, but you know, I knew that if we turn that computer off, we might never see that data again. And so I hold on to it for his parents against the day that we start to figure out, because this is going to be a problem lots of people have. I figure someone will figure out a thing to do with this within a decade or two, and then I'll have Possum's data.
As always, a brilliant mind ranging widely, Cory Doctorow, and I never have enough time with you because now I want to talk about that.
Yeah.
I want to talk about travel. We have so much to talk about, but we do have to let you go. So,
well, I'll see you someday in Petaluma.
Please.
I'd love to catch up with you. If you're ever down in Burbank, look me up.
I will, absolutely. It's such a pleasure to see you again and talk to you. Corey's new book is called Walk Away. And look, you got to get it. That's all I can say. Just get it and read it and love it. Thank you, Cory. We do Triangulation every Monday, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern, 1800 UTC. Tune in, watch it live, participate. Got some great questions for the chat room today. But if you can't, don't worry. We've got on-demand audio and video available everywhere, including our website, twit.tv/TRI. Unencrypted, un-DRM'd. Pass it around. Share it with your friends. And you know what? You'd do me a big favor if you'd subscribe, because that way you won't miss an episode. And really, every episode of this is gold. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time on Triangulation. Bye-bye.